Today, it is our privilege to take you on a journey through one of the most respected and revered wine countries in the world. It has been a long-time goal of the Grape Encounters team to spend an extended period of time exploring the state of Oregon's breathtaking Willamette Valley. Known mostly for its world-class Pinots, the raves these Burgundian wines are getting is just a small part of the story. That's why your host, David Wilson, decided to pack his bags and devote an entire month of Grape Encounters to a full immersion deep dive into the wines of Northwest Oregon. So, climb aboard the Grape Encounters transporter as we whisk you away on our first week in the very hospitable and world-class Willamette Valley.
Crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow.
It has been a long time coming, but I finally have made it to an American wine country that has taken a well-earned place on the world wine stage. I didn't want to come here until I could devote a significant amount of time visiting a range of wineries that represent a cross-section of this region. As a result, we're going to spend the next 4 weeks bringing Grape Encounters to you from the breathtaking Willamette Valley, located in Northwest Oregon. It's a place where you'll find true winemaking pioneers who have no inclination to copy what their counterparts in other regions do. Nope, these winemakers are quick to point out that Oregon wines are best when they're allowed to express their sense of place. And to that end, I couldn't be happier than to be at Highland Estates, where we are joined by Laurent Matelou. Thank you for joining us today. You have such an interesting operation here. You have been just about everywhere in the wine world and ended up in Oregon. I have so many questions for you, but let's start from the beginning. Do we start in Bordeaux?
Yes, so I graduated from the Bordeaux Institute of Enology and then had an opportunity to go west to make wine in Napa for a couple of vintages. I was very fortunate and enjoyed it immensely.
Okay, but as I understand it, you did a little time in the Caribbean as well.
That's where I grew up.
Caribbean.
The Lesser Antilles. So I was in Guadeloupe pretty much my whole bringing up from 0 to 24, which was not a bad place to be.
So why did you not get into the rum business?
That's a good question. Maybe that's for next life.
Have you ever had any temptation to get into the, you know, micro spirit business?
I really haven't, but actually one of my winemakers here, Anne Siri, who is French, but from the island of La Réunion, is actually very, very interested in spirits. So we may have to dabble into it. We'll see.
So you're in Guadeloupe, right?
Yes.
It's from there that you go back to Bordeaux?
Right. Well, the reason for the French departments in the Caribbean are connected to specific areas of France, and that was connected to Bordeaux, and that's also where my family is from. So that's why I went back to finish high school and college. So that's where I ended up.
But you did some winemaking there, and you were with some pretty top brands.
Oh, it's been great. You know, I was at Chateau La Tour Blanche, and I had a small internship where I traveled through the Médoc region. That was really fun.
How hard is it to get an internship as a young man in Bordeaux and the Médoc region?
Well, you know, that was a requirement for us at the Institute of Enology.
Okay.
And so, fortunately, most of the estates do like to have an internship program. We, subsequently here in Oregon, have implemented a great internship program where every year we have interns from all around the world. And it's just a fascinating way to enhance our own knowledge, at the same time hopefully giving them a good training. But it's just a fantastic way to open your mind and have, you know, a diversity of mindsets.
So why not stay in France? What took you to Napa? That's almost sacrilegious, right?
It was, you know, and quite frankly, I had two choices. It was South Africa or Napa. I wanted to learn English, and I thought that was critical. And then I never turned back. I loved the working environment. I loved the climate, loved the quality of the wines that were being produced. So I just fell in love with the whole West Coast. And I was later called to start a winery in the southern part of Oregon. And I was 24, and my former employee said, hey, do you know how to run this? I'm like, sure, not a problem.
Before we jump into that, tell me from your perspective, well-respected California wines are in France. I mean, after the Judgment of Paris, Did things change, or is there still some serious competition there?
There's no doubt there's still some serious competition. I think in the average mindset of people, we're very regional as far as our taste and what we drink in France, or you can see the same thing in Italy or Spain, where actually we drink wine that I was in a stone's throw away of where we grow up. So Changing the mindset of a lot of those people will take centuries.
So talking about the comparison between Oregon wines and French wines, specifically Pinots,
right.
I'm curious about something because I know that terroir is everything to you.
Mm-hmm.
And as I understand it, the Highland Vineyard is largely volcanic.
It's a volcanic origin. Yeah. So no, I think, you know, when the subject always comes up of comparing Oregon with Burgundy, of course, and the old world. As most of us in Oregon, we don't like that comparison because
you were anticipating my question.
Yeah, I overheard it. You know, it's an interesting subject. As most Oregonians are very proud of our own sense of place. So we don't like to compare ourselves with Burgundy. We like the diversity that Pinot Noir brings. And so there are some Pinot Noirs that are exceptional from, you know, Burgundy, and there are some other ones that are exceptional made here in Oregon with very different characteristic and different geological origin. So you hit it right on. For example, you spoke about Wollackensee. That's a sedimentary terroir. And then Highland, which you'll get to visit a little bit later on, is a volcanic origin. So a very different color, very different structures, very different expression of Pinot Noir.
See, that's what struck me as odd, is that you've got two very different terroirs, and then people are comparing them. And it seems to me that Oregon has come to the place where you don't want to be as good as somebody. You want to be held up as a benchmark for something that is unique unto itself, right?
That's exactly right. You know, you want to be expressing the very best emotion coming from that ground. And so therefore, you're unique. And, you know, you don't compete against your neighbor. He doesn't have the same ground than you do. So you are just trying your very best to express, again, that feeling, that emotion that comes out from that dirt. And that's why, you know, you were talking about Highland. We have this volcanic expression that we've farmed organically and biodynamically for the last 10 years now to get that best expression of the soil.
Hey, we are talking to Laurent Montelieu. We are at Highland Estates, and we're going to jump into that. But I want to understand what eventually takes you to Oregon wine country, because when you came here, it wasn't nearly as well known and popular and cherished, you know, as a production region as it is today. So did you foresee that it was going to be a great opportunity, or was there something else? Was it a girl?
Absolutely not. I wish I could tell you that, but no, I was 24 years old, just straight out of college, and I got a phone call from a gentleman, Bob Caravan, down in Southern Oregon, right at the border of California, that had just started a very, very tiny winery. And he called me up and said, hey, you know, I need a winemaker. Would you come up and check it out? And I was in Napa, so I jumped on a motorcycle, went up and I did, and fell in love with, you know, the area. You know, they gave me a great opportunity. I was there 7 years. And, you know, when they asked me, can you do all those things? I said, sure, no problem. Had not quite done them, except for theoretically in college.
That is the only way to get ahead in life.
Absolutely.
is to lie, right?
Well, yeah. I'm not sure about lying. I sure had the knowledge that I knew that I should be able to do it, I guess.
It's like building a rocket and not really being sure it's going to fly, but you think you know how it's going to work.
Absolutely.
Okay.
You need to go forward.
All right. So I just want to take one more stop before we get to Highland. Wollackensee, such a great brand.
Was the next step. Thank you. I was, you know, the winemaker, founder, partner of this venture, and it was a great venture. We started a production in 1995, but we planted the vineyards in 1992. So it's part of that era in Oregon where people realized that it was important to plant your own grapes and control your own destiny instead of buying grapes from other vineyards. So there was a lot of estate bottled winery that showed up in the 90s, Beaufrère, Christom, Archery Summit, Wollackensee. So all those places realized that we needed to control our own destiny, and we did some great progress viticulturally. And I think after 1994, you know, we had some great results with the press, and the wines of Oregon became very, very well known.
So there was a competition around that time between Oregon and the French winemakers, and apparently the judges couldn't tell the difference?
Well, you were about 2 decades off, which is okay. So
okay.
That was in 1976, and one of the wines...
Well, no, I know that's the Judgment of Paris, but I'm talking about later on. I think it was around 1985, wasn't there?
In 1985, there was one as well in New York, absolutely.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And in fact, one of the wine was Highland, from Highland Vineyard.
Oh, is that right?
So that's interesting. interesting. But yes, but in 1994, what happened, I think Parker gave some great scores to some, you know, wines, and that put all those wines on the forefront, and that was pretty amazing. I think what happened in 1994 was that Mother Nature lowered our crop level, so we had a poor set, which can happen here in Oregon, with a not-so-ideal weather during bloom. And by reducing the crop, all the growers realized that if we cropped not at 5 tons to the acre, but at 2.5 and 3 tons, we were making some exceptional wine. So from that point on, viticultures took some leaps.
Bad is not always bad.
Exactly.
Hey, we're going to come back in just a second. Stay with us. We are doing a 4-week tour of Oregon. It's the first time that we've ever spent this much time in one region, but I really think that Oregon deserves this kind of recognition, and we want to give it here on Grape Encounters Radio, so don't go anyplace. We'll be right back from Dundee, Oregon.
Your special edition of Grape Encounters will continue from Northwest Oregon in just a moment. Perhaps you should pour one of Oregon's world-class Pinots to get you into a perfect frame of mind.
It's in the wine we drink, dirty dishes in the kitchen sink. The lights go out till the sun comes up. We are not alone.
He's setting down the wine glass and picking up the microphone. Here's your Grape Encounters host, David Wilson.
The things we tell each other without saying a word.
We are back with Grape Encounters Radio, sitting in the office of, I'm going to call him a legend because he has had such a huge impact on the Oregon wine business. It is Laurent Matelou, who is the founder of Highland Estates, Willa Kenzie as well, a really sensational brand, right?
Originally, and I was the first winemaker there, yeah.
I told you off mic, during the break that my brother and sister-in-law gave me a membership to Willa Kenzie, and when those wines came, it was so exciting. They didn't make it past the third day, basically. They were gone.
Good. That's the idea.
The subject always comes up of varietal correctness, and that term bothers me terribly because I always wonder what is correct according to what. Because if you are making wines in Oregon and we are being true to the terroir and letting the grapes speak for themselves, then...
You're always correct, huh?
Yeah, you're correct according to Oregon standards, I suppose. Oregon. Yeah.
Well, any standard that you put to yourself, I would guess, you know, because, again, my goal as a winemaker is to make a wine that has a sense of place. So as long as a cultivate the vineyard, as long as I make sure that the expression of that particular ground goes into the wine, then again, like you said, for lack of a better word, I'm correct.
I got you. So let's talk about other varietals for a second. You do obviously make wonderful Pinots, but you're making some other varietals that are interesting to me as well. Riesling, right?
Gewürztraminer. We make Riesling, Gewürztraminer. We have one of the oldest planting at Highland. It was planted in 1971. So I was referring to Papa Pinot earlier. He planted the very first vines in 1965. This vineyard was planted in 1971. So it's an amazingly old and mature vineyard. You'll see those vines. They look like trees. They're very fascinating. But most importantly, the root system, of course, goes down 30 feet or so. And that expression of the terroir is fantastic. And Riesling especially, as well as Gewürz. But Riesling, I think, has that minerality element that is pretty tremendous. So yes, it's a fun variety. We are now also, I think, doing very, very well with Chardonnay. It's a different expression of Chardonnay. Again, you know, of course, the big, fruity, oaky Chardonnay from California are still dominating the wine world here in the U.S.
You say that with a smirk on your face.
Well, I think because we are on a path to kind of take over a little bit with our Oregon Chardonnay. They have some of that roundness and fatness, but they have that minerality and that zestiness. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. We're literally situated stylistically in between France and California, and I think that we'll conquer a lot of fans with our Chardonnay.
You are throwing down the gauntlet, aren't you?
We are trying.
I'm looking forward to later to trying some of the Chardonnays because I haven't had your Chardonnays, but that's going to be pretty exciting. Why the Riesling and Gewürztraminer? Those seem like strange bedfellows with a French winemaker making Chardonnay and Pinot.
Well, in all frankness, Riesling was planted when we purchased the property in 2007 and Gewürztraminer. As I said, they were planted in 1971. So having access to those old vines was just a tremendous opportunity as a winemaker. You know, we very often dream of making wine from vines that are that old. It's a great opportunity as a winemaker.
Were those varietals that you were familiar with?
Not at all. But, you know, I think, white winemaking, kind of the same principles applied to a lot of different varieties, of course. I was always fascinated with the wine of Alsace and certainly the Riesling, the Gewürztraminer, the German wines as well. So having that opportunity to work with not only those variety, but vines that old was pretty awesome.
We have almost no time left, but I did want to talk for a moment about the wines that you make here. You have a couple of different brands of your own, and then you make a lot of wine for a lot of different people. So let's just kind of give me a profile of what you're making and how do you find it?
Right. So we have the Highland Estate brand. Then I've also started a Solena brand, which is named after my daughter. And one of the new exciting projects, which is really fun for us, is Westmount Wine. And Westmount is actually distributed throughout the United States.
And that is Westmount.
Yes.
And you're going to find that most any place?
Pretty much. We are now just launching this year. We are in almost 11 markets. And the most important, like California, et cetera, are already launched. But within the next 2 to 3 years, will be in all markets. So it's a fun venture as a journey west, and that's the name comes going west to the mountain, Westmount.
This is one of these things that we talk about a lot on the show, is the idea of second brands, second and third brands. So many times people can't afford that premier brand from a company, but you have, you know, essentially grapes coming from the same place, or at least grown with the same instincts, made in the same facility, guided by the hands of a winemaker who, you know, is making all
same
of these
team.
Other premier wines. So these are value wines though, right?
Yeah, it's a good terminology, I think. They're still very varietal specific and very true to the area, but they offer an opportunity for the savvy shopper that wants to make sure his dollar goes a little further to enjoy Pinot Noir.
What is the sweet spot right now for wine, for the consumer who wants good wine, but, you know, doesn't have that much disposable income
right.
to be able to spend $40 on a bottle?
Well,
what is
so
the sweet spot?
I think half of what you just said. So the $20 segment seems to be doing very well, and that's exactly where we've positioned Westmount Pinot Noir.
Can you make money at that price?
Yes. When you have a large property, it's all about the growing of the grapes. So you have a large property. Not every single acre of that property is designed to make the very best wine. So you have some areas that might be a little bit more generous as far as the yields that it gives us, and therefore, you know, has a much lower cost of grapes. And so those are the grapes that are still very flavorful, are still beautifully grown, are still handcrafted, as you mentioned, but, you know, make it into a wine that is a little bit more reasonable.
And no tinkering.
No, you know, it's we don't need to. That's the beauty of winemaking. We have some exceptional grapes grown in Oregon, and so there is no need to really do anything else. Oregon is very, very strict on our labeling law. We have what we call the toughest labeling law. So if you put a variety on the bottle, it's 90 to 95% that variety.
Oh, so is that right?
There is very little, tinkering?
The 75% rule doesn't apply here.
It doesn't apply in Oregon. Oregon is 90 and 95%.
Isn't that amazing? You know what? I never knew that.
We call that the truce in labeling.
Oh, thank goodness, because I am so anti-tinkering. I have one last question for you, okay? And it's so exciting to be able to be sitting here with you, and this is why I'm asking the question. It's your fault, actually. I have a love-hate relationship with Pinot. I always tell people there's a lot of good Pinot out there, but there's a lot more bad Pinot out there, especially after the movie Sideways had its little impact, you know, having a fictional character tell us what we should be drinking. And then everybody rips out their Merlot and plants Pinot. And when I got that membership to Willa Kenzie, it really turned me on to Oregon Pinots.
Mm-hmm. I think it's about, you know, growing Pinot Noir and making Pinot Noir in appropriate fashion. As you said, after the movie Sideways, everybody wanted to make Pinot Noir. Everybody planted Pinot Noir. But there was not necessarily a goal to strive to make the very best Pinot Noir at times, which I think has changed. So there's been some standards raised, even in Oregon. And we are now mandated by our customers to make great Pinot Noir every year. The climate, of course, of Oregon will fluctuate and give us some variation of quality, but we have absolutely no excuse as viticulturists, as winemakers, to not make a great Pinot Noir every year. And then certain vintages will give us exceptional quality.
Yeah. You know, I don't know that you can judge a wine strictly by region. That's not fair at all, but it boils down to this. If you like it, buy it, drink it.
That's exactly
right.
That's
the end of story.
The only thing that counts is one sum up. You like it, you drink it, you enjoy it. That's your choice.
Laurent Matalou, I really appreciate you coming on today. Really been a pleasure, and I get to spend more time. We're going to go down the road, hang out at the vineyard. We will be back with more Grape Encounters coming to you from the Willamette Valley of Oregon. It's just one of the most spectacular wine growing regions in the world, not in the United States, in the world. We'll be back in just a moment.
This special Grape Encounters visit to the Willamette Valley will continue in a couple of minutes, so don't go anywhere. And now, Grape Encounters with David Wilson continues.
Won't you stay on the menu for the summer? Won't you stay on the menu for the year? We could waste a little summertime together. Stay, cause you might like it here.
Hey, back with Grape Encounters Radio, and now we are taking you way out into the boonies, and I am going to introduce two new guests. We're kind of continuing on with our friends at Highland, but the baton has now been passed to Colin Eddy. He's the National Sales Manager, and welcome, Colin, first of all.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for coming all the way out here to the boonies that is McMinnville, Oregon.
Yeah, we've got a passenger along. He's somebody that's really important to your operation, Aaron Bartels. He is a fine wine specialist with Southern Glazers Wine and Spirits of Oregon, formerly known as Southern Wines and Spirits, right?
Yes, now as Southern Glazers Wine and Spirits, we have grown into every state in the country, which is very exciting as a distributor.
And you guys represent Highland Estates.
Proudly.
And that explains why we're all together here in a pickup truck. And first of all, let me just say, this is the most extraordinary view you could practically ever see in the wine world. I don't know where you would go and see anything more beautiful than this.
Well, thank you very much.
You're laughing. Why? Because you take this for granted, don't you?
You know, I don't. I think I spoke to you a little bit earlier when we were driving around is that, you know, I came from Texas, and the first time we came up here, we just had to figure out a way to live here. And, you know, having the opportunity to see this regularly, I will never take for granted. But location-wise, we're about 8 miles southeast of the town of McMinnville. Still technically in McMinnville and in the McMinnville AVA, but from the town, we're about 8 miles southeast.
And definitely still Willamette Valley, which goes on for like 100 miles, right, at least?
All the way down to Eugene now.
Okay, but how far is that?
So Eugene is about 90 miles from here.
Okay, great. So let's talk about the vineyard that we're staring at, because this is probably one of the most significant vineyard, would it not be, in Oregon? Or certainly one of them.
It would definitely be the largest contiguous single ownership vineyard in all of Oregon.
Oh, the largest contiguous.
Yes.
And it's funny because it's, what, 200 and I want to say 76 acres, something around there?
It's just about 260 acres total.
Okay, 260 acres, which wouldn't be gigantic in other parts of the world, but for Oregon, it is.
It is. Many Oregon wineries are very small. The average Oregon winery makes about 5,000 cases of wine, and a 260-acre vineyard can produce quite a bit of fruit. So this is not a normal-sized vineyard for all of Oregon, and we never take that for granted.
You make a really interesting point that the production that you get off of an acre in Oregon is going to be considerably higher than what you would get in other parts of the country. That would be a weather factor more than anything, right?
Year to year, it certainly differs here in Oregon, not as drastically as you would see overseas in Burgundy or Bordeaux, but we're significantly affected by the weather. We had about a 35% decrease in all fruit, you know, being grown in Oregon during the 2011-2013 years, whereas 2014, 2015, and 2016 have all been very generous harvests, earliest harvest, and warmest harvest on record.
But those years that you had low production, you also had great quality, did you not?
Absolutely. And those wines, they take a lot longer to open up and really show that great cranberry fruit, great bright cherry that Oregon's about. But you give them a couple of years, and those wines are phenomenal. Just absolutely out of this world.
All right, let me go back to Aaron. When I say back, you're in the back seat.
I'm in the back, yes.
You get the whole back seat in this.
It's very comfortable, yes.
Do you get a chance to get out and see these kinds of properties? Because they're really so hidden away. I would not have expected to find anything like this. When we came around the corner, it was just like, holy smoke, yeah. Look at this.
Yeah, because we spent a good hour, you know, plugging along, you know, going through forests and that sort of thing, running into deer along the way. And then just out of nowhere behind the trees was this beautiful slope, this beautiful bowl that opens up before us, and just symmetrically planted vines going all the way up the hill to the crest of it. And it's spectacular. No, I'm very lucky to go to some of our vineyards, but this is my first time getting to see Highland Estate, and it is just dramatic and very touching.
So, first of all, thank you. When we reached out to arrange visits to some of the really great winemakers of Oregon, you guys were so great to help us out with that. And you have been my faithful tour guide.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. We have plenty more ground to cover too. So,
oh yeah, many more days to go here. It's going to be very exciting. And we had to come to a place like this because nowhere else will you find Gewürztraminer planted back in 1971, or for instance, Curie Clone Pinot Noir as well, planted back in the 70s.
Like, so that was a cross between Pinot Noir and Curie the Spice, right? makes for a very spicy Pinot.
Yeah, great pairing, honestly, yeah. It's just a very rare thing that's grown these days. Most of the Curry clones were pulled out of the ground back in the day. But no, it was a guy named Charles Curry back in the 60s who stole it from Alsace, packed it in his suitcase, and came here with it and planted it. So we're very...
Now, if you do that today, you transport something from one country to another, you're in big trouble.
Oh, yeah. Your TSA will lock you down and keep you there.
It's not the TSA. It's...
Agricultural Services or...
Yeah. Who is it that would lock you up? Anyway, who wants to give a little history of this property? Because 1971, there wasn't much happening as far as Oregon wine was concerned. I mean, there was a little bit going on, but very little.
Yeah. I mean, at the time, you basically had a few people from UC Davis who had come up here, like David Lett, for instance, in the late 60s, planting Pinot Noir. And this vineyard, on their heels, basically, was planted in 1971. And the Gewurztraminer still produces fruit to this day. The Riesling was planted in 1972, and after that, soon after, the Curry clone Pinot Noir and other varieties as well. And so this is a pretty special gem.
So going back to you, Colin, for a second, this vineyard was purchased by your company not that terribly long ago.
No, this vineyard was purchased in 2007.
Right, and I think you had indicated it was in pretty bad shape, right?
It wasn't necessarily in bad shape, but it wasn't in the best shape. And as Laurent likes to say, we went in, we cleaned it up, and we continued to do the right things by the vineyard day in and day out as we sit here today in 2017.
So how does a Gewurztraminer vine survive so beautifully as those that we just looked at? And I just have to say, they were really unusual. I mean, they're just tremendously huge. They've got moss growing all over them. You would never see that in the part of the country that I come from, but do they produce really as well as they did 20 years ago, or are they slowly going downhill? And will they have to come out someday?
Eventually, yes, they will stop producing. And we've seen a little bit of a decline in production over the last few years. But what we do see is really vibrant, you know, great, cool climate, acidic Gewurztraminer that comes out of them. I mean, it's really beautiful fruit and something that you just don't find out here in the valley other than here at this property. It's something very special to us, something that we hold dear to our heart and we're proud to make and we're proud to distribute.
Now, the other thing that you showed us, and I don't know how many acres we're looking at here that are planted in Chardonnay, but it seems like Chardonnay is like the next great hope of Oregon, that everybody seems to be talking Chardonnay right now and excited about the future of Chardonnay here in the state. Can you kind of give me an idea about, you know, what you've got planted and what your hopes are where Chardonnay is concerned?
So with Chardonnay, I think you hit it dead on. And while we've consistently been known for Pinot Noir, Chardonnay is definitely the next big thing coming, I think, for Oregon. And a lot of it has to do with climate. Like I said earlier, we've had 3 straight years of earliest harvest on record and warmest summers on record. And what that does is it produces a bigger style of Chardonnay. And while we still have that mineral backbone that Oregon is about, I think that it's producing a Chardonnay that, you know, people around the country and people around the world have been craving from Oregon for a long time.
So if you make a bigger style Chardonnay, does that reduce the amount of need to spend time in oak? Does that compensate in the other direction? Because, you know, sometimes oak is used, I think, as a way of, you know, sprucing up a Chardonnay that really is a little on the impotent side. And so let's just add oak. And, you know, I've tasted some over oak Chardonnays that are just disgraceful, mostly because they weren't big enough to handle the oak to begin with.
You know, the one thing I would say regarding that is that each winemaker's style will come out in each bottle of wine. I mean, you know, Laurent does not believe, our winemaker and owner doesn't believe in a huge oak presence. I think that might be a little bit of the French in him, but we certainly want to let that minerality shine through. You know, in other wineries, we can't necessarily speak for them, but what I see as an overwhelming quality here in Oregon is that people really do want that minerality to shine through, and we don't see a whole lot of over-oaking, whether it be with French oak or American oak.
Okay, how about you, Aaron? Large oak, medium oak, no oak. What's it going
to
be?
Oh, gosh. Put a gun to my head. Honestly, it depends on the situation. It depends what I'm eating with it. You know,
see, that's a great answer, you know?
It's context, man. You know, it's all about when and where. If I'm in the mood and I just want a glass of something, a big oaky Chardonnay is glorious. But if I've got a beautiful piece of white fish and I'm going to squeeze a little bit of lemon on it, I don't want to see the oak. I want to see just a bright, crisp Chardonnay that maybe sees some neutral time in oak, doesn't see malolactic fermentation. It is just bright and crisp.
Well, the nice thing is that we went from little or no oak, too much oak, medium oak, and now all three. And That's a good thing. We're all about choices here in America. Hey, guys, hang with me for a second. We're going to run to the top of the hill now and get a completely different view. So stay with me. We will be back from the beautiful Highland Vineyard, and we are in the Willamette Valley, and I am taking a tour along with Aaron Bartels, who's a fine wine specialist for Southern Glazers Wine and Spirits of Oregon, who's arranged my whirlwind trip. Our tour guide for this particular piece of property, Colin Eddy, he is the national sales manager for Highland Estates Wines, making a lot of really great wines. You guys have now four brands.
Yes, sir, we do.
All right. If you call me sir, I'm not going to let you drink. All right. Well, we will return with more Grape Encounters right after this.
In just a minute, we'll continue our very special four-part series of Grape Encounters from the breathtaking Wine Nirvana wine region, better known as Oregon's Willamette Valley. Perhaps you should pour one of Oregon's world-class Pinots to get you into the perfect frame of mind. And don't forget to join our Grape Encounters Radio Facebook group page, where incredibly fun people just like you share ideas and frequently get together to share a bottle as well. And now, Grape Encounters with David Wilson continues.
I'm going to some place where you know I've never been before.
All right, I know where I'm going to build my second home. I am sitting right now at my home site. I think I'm going to have to get permission, however, from the folks at Highland Estates. Colin Eddy is the national sales manager. Are you able to grant permission for me to build a home at the top of this vineyard, or am I going to have to talk to Laurent?
I think you might have to talk to Laurent, but also the state of Oregon about ripping out some of these trees.
No, we're just going to rip out a few of those vines right there. See, right there, that's where my home site's going to be. Pool is going to be right there. And then this is a really steep piece of property, so my water slide is going to go from right here down to the bottom right there to that cluster of trees.
Gravity's a beautiful thing, isn't it?
Okay. So let me get back to you, Aaron, because you know an awful lot about Oregon wines, but you also sell to the restaurants and bars and, you know, in Portland. Mm-hmm. What is that like when you walk in to a customer and you have your portfolio of Oregon wines and you have wines from other parts of the country? Are you prejudiced in any way? Be honest with me.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean,
you
I,
are.
I was born here. I was raised here, and I came back here after college in another life.
And you went to college in
California, God help me, at USC for undergrad, and then I went to grad school at UT Austin, but that was all for archaeology. My focus was digging in the dirt. The dirt just, you know, led me along, and I loved it. I mean, I got to dig in Tuscany for 5 summers. I dug in Pompeii, and on weekends, though, I'd spend all my time just helping out at the winery that we lived at. I would prune vines. I would help spray the vineyard.
And where was the winery?
Up in Tuscany, up in a little town called Vicchio, just south of Borgo San Lorenzo and north of Florence. And
yeah.
I just fell in love with it. The people were wonderful. They'd send their kids out during the day. They'd come back with these huge feasts of wild boar and rabbit and everything else. And we'd all bring wine. And we'd all just share our wines and talk about the day and what we found, what we didn't find. And I loved it. But at the same time, I thought, you know, this isn't a lifetime career.
I need to put this together for a second, because you go away to USC. Mm-hmm. You study archaeology. Mm-hmm. And USC is not a cheap school to go to.
I got a scholarship. My family are cattle ranchers. So yeah, I got
all right, because I was sitting here thinking about your parents writing checks for you to go to USC to study archaeology, and then you go off to Tuscany and you're using paintbrushes to, you know, look for bones in the dirt, and then all of a sudden, because you're working a summer job to be able to buy pizza, decide that your heart is really in the winemaking business, and the archaeology profession be damned.
Be damned, honestly. I mean, I loved it and I loved going abroad, but at the same time, you know, what's better than getting paid to drink?
Colin, how many would-be archaeologists have you met in your life?
To be honest,
he's the first one, right?
I got to give it to you. It's zero. Yeah,
yeah, I'm like sitting here thinking, let's see, how many people have I talked to who were going to be archaeologists? Okay. Like, that's like the ultimate cool profession. I must admit, there are a lot of people I know in the wine business. Archaeology, not so much.
Well, dirt doesn't pay.
What about a wine archaeologist? Because, you know, there are always those guys that are out there that are digging up bowls that they said, you know, they fermented stuff in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We used to do analysis at Reed College here in Portland, Oregon. Reed College has its own nuclear reactor. And we sent them pottery. And I flew up from USC with the pottery. And we'd pop it into the reactor and figure out exactly what was put into that pot. They were fermenting grapes. They were fermenting honey. You name it. And it was really exciting to learn that. But at the same time, again, it just kept leading me to drinking and led me to getting interested in wine. And so one thing led to another. I worked in a wine shop for a while in upstate New York and just had to come back home.
It's always sunny and it never rains.
Always sunny in Portlandia.
Okay.
Not really.
All right. So there is a tendency, let's going back to the original question, a tendency to go in and kind of push the Oregon wines. But what about the consumer here in Oregon? Are they as interested in wines from out of the area as they are the wines in the area? Or are they pretty hot on the home team?
We're definitely locavores. We love what we have. We love what we grow here. And we're very focused on what we produce.
But isn't that an Oregonian trait in general? Because we were talking on the drive up here about the soccer team, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And like, what goes on at those soccer games?
Oh, with the Timbers, it's insane. I mean, people are absolutely manic. You know, they're screaming and chanting the whole time. If you're part of the Timbers Army, which is the core group of football watchers, you're standing the entire game chanting and waving flags. And I think it's the same way with food and wine in Portland. You know, they want to know where their food's coming from. They want to know where their wine's coming from. And so if it's an animal that was hunted in some nearby farm organically, they want to know that. They want to know what's happening.
Get to know the thing you killed and eat.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay.
At the same time, though, I think there is very high interest in international wines, especially Italian wines. This is a big market for Italian wine. So half the time I'm showing either Italian or French or Oregonian.
Italian, French, or Oregonian.
Mm-hmm.
And either one of you, any idea why that might be?
People are really into wine, and they're happy to be educated about it here. And
but just south of here, there's a state that I think makes some pretty good wines down there.
It's true.
Is there a sense of competition between Oregon and California?
Oh, it's intense.
Because I don't know that in California there is that. I don't think California necessarily feels competitive with anybody because they make so much wine.
Yeah.
But is there a sense here in Oregon that we'd like to really up the production to a great degree?
I think, yeah, it's like the bumper sticker says, keep Portland weird. They want to keep it interesting and keep it as local as possible. So there is, you know, some pushback against wines coming from California, especially Pinot Noir. The hardest thing in my life to sell in Oregon is Pinot Noir from California. I love some of them. Saintsbury is a magical Pinot. There's amazing stuff coming out of Carneros and that sort of thing. But at the same time, my buyers don't want it. And the customers don't want it. It's a hard sell.
I don't know if I should have let that go out over the airwaves.
Okay.
We have just a second left in this show. I'm going to end it with you, Colin, for a second. You are out all over the country selling the Highland brand. And what is the sense of intrigue that people have with Oregon? I mean, people are certainly familiar with California. If you get out to the East Coast, they're certainly familiar with New York wines. And even states like Virginia, you get to the East Coast, there's a lot of wines being made on the East Coast. And they consume the wines that are made there more than even exporting them into other states. What about Oregon? Truly, and I don't want to hear the commercial for Highland. I want to hear the real deal.
I think Oregon, for a lot of people, is that last mystical great frontier that hasn't been conquered. And I think that's a good reference when you look at the wine business. I mean, hey, look, we're in the infancy of where California would be if you put them in our shoes, you know, this many years down the road.
True.
You know, there's a lot of things that we want to do to emulate California, and there's a lot of things that we want to do to keep Portland weird, keep Oregon itself. I think it's an undefined wine region. I think we've got a lot of work to do. I think there's a lot of new people and new faces and new ideas to come. And I think that intrigues people. I think it also intrigues people when you have a vineyard site that has stood the test of time and you have a lot of original plantings of 1971, rootstock, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Gewürztraminer. To that, it intrigues people. The last great frontier with, you know, 46-year-old vines. It's really just a lot of fun.
But nobody's ever going to see this vineyard except the photographs of it that we took today and that you guys might publish online or someplace else, because you can't come here unless you know somebody. All right, guys, we got to call it a day. It is time for us to head back down that dirt road that got us here. I can't thank you enough, Colin, for taking us out here. This was a treat. And I must tell you that I did a lot of reading up on this property. There's a lot that's written about it. Nothing that I have read about this does this justice. It's just really unique. All right, guys, that's going to do it for Grape Encounters today. Colin, thank you very much. Colin Eddy from Highland Estates. You can check out Highland's wines at highlandestateswinery.com or just Google Highland in Oregon and you will find it. And you'll find Southern wines absolutely everywhere.
And we are around.
But yes. You don't actually make wine.
No, actually I do at home, but that's a different matter.
Oh, you make wine at home. I know what we're going to be doing as soon as we sign off. That'll do it for Grape Encounters this week. And we will see you next week.